I headed there, towards the ship, and as soon as I reached the foot of the staircase I stopped and looked up, perceiving at the door a tall bodily form, enveloped in a kind of multicolored halo. Immediately I heard the voice again, "Do not be afraid. Come aboard our ship, we want to talk to you." With a Central American tribe, a Catalan reporter, Joe Aquin Grau, with the help of photographer Leopoldo Samso, has offered us a wonderful book from which we are forced to transcribe several passages. Like this one, "Life is much less terrifying than literature." The Orcas, a tribe reputed to be living wild in the lands of the eastern Ecuadorian Amazon, were simply giving me a lesson in healthy spontaneity. They do not form, like us, the civilized, a society of voyeurs. They have not repressed the sense of touch. They touch like a child touches another child. They absorb information through all their senses, especially through touch. It is not enough for them to see things. Things must be touched. Direct contact must be established with them, felt, the purest and most intimate communion created. You have to touch. And they, especially men and children, patted my body, checked its texture, opened my pants, searched. And they laughed, laughed like children who had just discovered a new world. Quinto the guide, whose father was Quechua and whose mother was Orca, saved them all that discovery work. As soon as he reached the hut he took off his clothes and stood as naked as the Orcas. I confess that I regret not having that spontaneity. Unfortunately, almost 2,000 years of Judeo-Christian repression weighed heavily on me. Grant Samso's book reached me on June 26, 1981, and shortly after reading it, I published a long illustrated review in the Diario de Barcelona. The selected texts had been underlined by me almost 2 months before my meeting with them. In view of so many coincidences in the essential approaches to human life, could it be suspected that the Orcas are extraterrestrials or that they are related to them? On the other hand, at this point I, and everyone, is entitled to ask, how many senses have been annulled in us, not only by the Judeo-Christian repression, which is no small thing, but by all those civilizations that have taken over the world, with predominantly religious roots. And how many incalculable precious displays of spontaneity and naturalness have we lost along the rugged path that successive civilizations have traced and imposed on us throughout time? Until we ended up in this sad situation of robots with human appearance in which, with great strides, legions of human beings are falling in line with. Remembering the nakedness of the Orcas, I asked another question, and those clothes that you wear, those overalls that look like uniforms, are they obligatory on your planets? Are there no nudists among them? Please pay attention, the voice replied. Another documentary, images of people from the planet's deep lakes, they told me bathing naked in a lake, began to appear before my eyes. I immediately realized that it was a small underground sea, surrounded by a kind of white modules, similar to the igloos of the Eskimos, with small holes that served as windows, and with entrances, but without doors. All of this surrounded by vegetation that gave the impression of having been miniaturized. I saw weeping willows that would not rise more than 3 meters from the ground. The ceiling of the lake seemed to be made of transparent plastic, and would be about 10 meters above the water level. Clothes, the voice pointed out, are part of us at certain moments in our lives. For example, this halo that you see around our bodies is only used when we approach Earth, as an immunization against your contaminations, the harmful effects of which even you are unable to calculate, and we can also use it as a protective shield if necessary. We just have to increase its density. I couldn't help but say, with a hint of bad temper, "So, you are not safe from accidents or breakdowns, are there?" "Of course not. But any fault occurring can be corrected on the fly thanks to our prevention systems. What we are most concerned about is not transporting Earth's contamination to other environments, which would create temporary problems." For the first time, their words had taken on a somewhat joking tone, or so it seemed to me, which forced me to look up from the screen and look more closely at their faces, and I could see that, looking at each other, they were smiling. I don't know, but it seems to me that these images would be more beautiful with some sound or music. That's true, sorry. And immediately I heard the murmur, very soft, typical of a place where there are people bathing. I thought, I would like to see a football or rugby match, with these people so silent in the stands and on the grass. It would seem like a silent film. The voice added, well, unless you like to hear a particular kind of music. That I had not yet absorbed much of the kindness of my hosts was demonstrated by the music I requested, as if to make it difficult for them, which was a record that I listened to every day while I was shaving, during the 50s and 60s. I think I even hardened my voice a little to ask them for the Concierto d'Aranjuez performed by jazz trumpeter Miles Davis, with an arrangement by Bill Evans. What a surprise I had when I heard the first notes of such a beautiful piece of music, and its no less beautiful arrangement, join the last syllables of my request. I felt a great shame, to be honest, and even why not say it? A certain humiliation, thinking, once again, of our unfortunate earthly pride. And then a long silence fell again. I kept watching them. And I noticed, in particular, the emblems they wore. I don't know if they were sewn, glued or embroidered on their chests, at the height of their hearts. They were about 12 to 15 centimeters high. Its profile, 3 or 4 millimeters wide, was black. Only what looked like an eye, in the center, I would call it the living eye, was multicolored, with bright and changing colors. It was a multi-prism eye. The first memory that came to mind was the green eyes, of changing tones depending on whether the day was sunny or cloudy, which resembled little flowers in a permanent mutation of shades, of my first companion and mother of my 4 children. Those eyes too, which were extinguished forever one day in July 1964, were configured in an infinity of changing prisms, but the eye of these emblems was something very out of the ordinary. Looking at them, one had the sensation of sailing through space or swimming in the most exotic depths of the sea or a lake. It was a fascinating spectacle. At times they truly fascinated me. Then I reproduced this emblem from memory, and not only have we not been able to give it life but, with our insipid colors, I have the feeling that it is a sick emblem. At times I had the impression that, when they looked at me fixedly, they were reading my thoughts, as one reads the pages of an open book. And I, who was gradually getting used to giving them all kinds of capabilities, came to imagine that this would be the best way, if not to read, at least to try to guess their intentions for me. Although, in truth, why did I want to know what they were thinking of doing with me? For example, if it was very clear that they could do anything and that they seemed animated by the best of motives. But, I repeat, and this must be insisted upon as much as necessary, deep down I felt on a plane of great inferiority. I said to myself, apparently, these gentlemen have everything, they can teach us everything, help us with anything and, on the other hand, we, the inhabitants of the earth, the navel of the world, according to a refrain repeatedly intoned throughout the ages by our most illustrious thinkers, what could we teach them? To kill each other? To destroy the environment and export bombs to the cosmos? To put our own home in danger of being blowing up at any moment? After a brief silence I asked again, so, if on your planet there are no families, as on ours, there is no love or friendship either? Love. And companionship. They looked at each other again, as if wondering who of them was going to answer. It was the woman in front of me, slightly to my right, less than a couple of meters from me. I saw her lips move, slightly full, of a rather faded red. Although this matter of colors or tones, I must stress, once again, was something very relative, since, at least in my eyes, everything was conditioned by the prevalent white light in the environment. In our communities there are equivalent types of relationships, although we would say that they are more genuine. We have been refining our customs and our language, as is logical, enriching everything with the greatest spontaneity. And our naturalness has reached such a point, that our attitudes, acts or experiences hardly ever need to be embellished with words. Our constant concern, in this interesting subject, is to maintain the maximum sincerity in our relationships. We are people who speak much more with our behavior than with words. To better explain the feeling that presides over our relations, we will use a word that is somewhat unusual on your planet. It is the word companionship. Well, it depends on who you are talking about, I interrupted, because in libertarian circles that word has always been in common use. Yes, we already know that. But we are referring to the people of Earth in general. This state of mind or relationship sums up well the act of uniting people, communities, wills and efforts. And among us this lasts as long as the need to be in company, to accompany, to be accompanied, to recreate, enjoy, travel, investigate, explore, that is, to do something that we could not do alone. But all this has its natural limit, after which another perspective immediately opens up. You, the Earthlings, must always remember that we are free people, that we enjoy total freedom, without any kind of restrictions, because each individual, each community knows their rights and duties to the letter, to use your words. The mechanical ramp took me up to the top, to the door, which was situated about 4 or 5 meters from the ground. Before that I had been able to see that the ship was resting on 4 legs, which seemed to be tubular with articulated joints. From what I could see, the ship was a rather dark metallic color. As I crossed the entrance the voice said to me, "Welcome aboard the ship Light of the Cosmos," and with a gentle gesture, of the three who were waiting for me, the one closest to me indicated some seats in the center of that immense room, placed around an oval table. Freedom on a cosmic scale. For us, the rightly understood freedom of one is not that which ends where the freedom of another begins, which, when you look at it closely, it is a hollow phrase, like so many others used on Earth. Because, who can set the border between these two individual freedoms? Our freedom is that which overlaps, which harmonizes and which fuses with the freedom of others. Only in this way can collective freedom, which is genuine, be truly interwoven, and not with unrestricted freedoms to which only the chosen and the privileged can access, as happens on your planet. However, there is no one better than us to appreciate the efforts and sacrifices of certain groups of Earthlings, throughout the ages, to channel the existence of your communities more harmoniously. And we have also been able to see that those who best represented the most beautiful human ideals have often been losers, precisely because of their goodness. Just as you cannot put all the leadership teams in the same bag, there are those who could do many good things and do not do them, while others, who would like to do them, do not have the means to do so, or are frightened by the swordsman of the moment, the royal family of Spain in the spotlight. In this area too we can give a very accurate opinion of reality. You know how important the Mediterranean basin is for us and what we think about the peoples who surround it. See the chapter Why They Chose Me as Messenger. Well, although what we are going to tell you may shock you, because we know your intransigent republicanism, we have observed a lot of courage and a lot of naturalness in the behavior of your kings, who, if they persist in their path, are destined to play a much more important role than the current one. I confess that, when I heard these praises about the Spanish royal couple from the mouths of extraterrestrials, I was extremely surprised. Because, the truth is, in the long time that we had been chatting, they had not shown themselves at all inclined to take sides or indicate preferences, especially in the political affairs of Earth. It is not that it bothered me, but I did not jump for joy either, to be honest. But as politeness does not take away courage, I, despite my intransigent republicanism, reproduce here, without removing or adding a comma, what they told me. However, this requires an explanation. It is the result, above all, of my consistent anti-monarchy. I have never been able to admit, nor will I admit it as long as I live, that, sometimes by providential designs and other times by dictatorial whims, leaders of any kind have been imposed on me. On the other hand, in order to not have the slightest sympathy for the Bourbon dynasty, the then Spanish ruling family, it is enough for me to know the history of Spain. But there is more. I know very well, having lived it very intensely, our history of this last half century. And in particular the period that began in July 1936. Let me explain, the worst enemy that the monarchy has had, and still has, even before it was restored, is that of having the Count of Barcelona as chief strategist. I said so, in passing, in an article of mine, Francoism from Within. Mundo Diario, Barcelona, February 9, 1979. It is possible that the Count of Barcelona planned, in view of the situation, Franco told him, in 1948, among other inadequacies, that he planned to keep power for 20 more years, a long-term restoration. But let it be clear that he did not do the Spanish people any favors and a very poor service to the monarchy established in 1975. More about my interlocutors. I continued my ocular inspection of the rest of the crew. Only one of the men had almond-shaped eyes, much more prominent than those of the woman closest to me. The others had eyes like us on Earth, round, although larger and more prominent and, generally, quite wide-spaced from the nose. Later, during our long, pleasant and instructive conversation, they would tell me that this was due to periodic ocular gymnastics, which put their eyes in a position to encompass a much larger field of vision and thus capture an infinite number of details, and, at the same time, to be able to better express, with their gaze, what only the eyes can say. By the way, this eyes that speak thing reminded me of the times when, during my 5 long trips through Spain to write my book on the Spanish guerrillas, 1936 to 1960, I regretted not having taken with me one of those little cameras, miniaturized, that can be hidden under the lapel of a jacket. In this way I could have photographed many times the expressive eyes of peasants, peasant women, shepherds, charcoal burners, even sworn guards, which constituted the mute answer to certain questions of mine. With these photos, limited to the pair of eyes of each interviewee who gave me, I repeat, silence as an answer, we could have illustrated many pages that, without a doubt, would have been among the most eloquent, with my question printed above and in a box below, the corresponding silent response in their expressive eyes. The faces of my extraterrestrial male interlocutors were longer than ours, with the chin somewhat more prominent than the usual one in these latitudes. But their proportions were always harmonious. The one with the prominent cheekbones had an oriental air and was the shortest of all, 1.75 meters or a little more. Their lips were less fleshy than those of the women and the male faces seemed freshly shaven. At times they appeared to me like authentic wax figures. The ears were also elongated and attached to the head. They explained to me that the function of hearing was very important to them, not only because of the range of sound perception, but also to listen to silence. They told me this over and over again, no doubt so that I would be well aware of how important the absence of noise was to them, emphasizing that the transmission of this silence to their organism exerted a highly toning and revitalizing influence on their bodies, unparalleled by any type of preventive treatment, in the therefore extensive range of those that they have, and use, to maintain their lives in what we earthlings call good shape. Although we refer more specifically to physical shape, while in them it is a much more extensive scope. Their arms and legs seemed longer to me, and this is something that I also understood perfectly when I discovered that they walked a lot and that they did a lot of exercise during mountain or submarine explorations. Although we, they told me with a hint of irony, do not climb peaks to place flags or emblems there. We prefer to climb slowly and discover the people who live in these mountains, to learn about their lifestyle, the type of vegetation that surrounds them and the animals that inhabit them. The peaks have no other attraction for us than to admire the landscape from a higher vantage point. Although this is something that we can also enjoy perfectly from our ships, they continued to explain to me, attached great importance to not losing any detail of what was offered to their eyes. That is to say, not losing the human dimension of things. As I was able to see in the documentaries they showed me, they only use mechanical elements when absolutely necessary. Several times I was tempted to ask them if such a disciplined and regulated life did not end up being boring. But why was I thinking about discipline and regulations if they did everything in complete freedom? This would not be, of course, the last time that this kind of big question would arise in me, always supported by a sharp bewilderment, that of not quite believing the reality that was before my very nose. For the umpteenth time I remembered what I received as advice from both my parents and my teachers, including my physical education teacher, in 1932-1936, from the Barcelona Gymnastics Club, who was the Spanish champion in Greco-Roman wrestling, to always take good care of my body, of my health, because it would be of no use to me to study, make projects and draw up plans, if later, suffering from this or that ailment or illness, at the moment of undertaking them I found myself physically incapable. On the other hand, I told myself, I don't know if my companions had intended to occupy my mind thoroughly, but what was becoming evident, every now and then, was that I continued to be stubborn in my earthly approaches. Because, naturally, if they had put me in a position to take in impressions without assimilating them on my own, at least the most essential ones to understand life, this interview would have turned out to be a made-in-Tierra scam and the first to be deceived would be them. It was then that I realized how lucky I had been. I was conducting, with difficulty, the first interview that extraterrestrials have ever granted to an inhabitant of the Earth. And, in addition, to a writer and historian, someone from the lineage of anthropologists who have never set foot in the jungle called me chronicler of history, a practitioner of oral history told by those living history and who, on the other hand, had been granted the privilege of boarding one of their ships and chatting with them for several hours. I must also confess that I felt I did not know how to respond to their courtesy with greater spontaneity. I should have been less surly and tried much harder than I did to move mentally into more open, less dark territory. Of one thing I was also increasingly certain, that I must try to amass in my mind these unusual materials for reflection and that this was a mental effort that I had to undertake, without further ado, at my own risk, if I really wanted to understand them and derive some benefit from our meeting. The table looked like those we see in radio studios, with several handles, and from the center emerged some retractable screens, on one of which I could admire several documentaries that dealt with, among other things, their travels, the receptions that the populations of the planets they visited had reserved for them, popular festivals, mini saucer dives into the seas, and several other episodes, most of the time with extraterrestrial people and other times with Earthlings as the main protagonists. The final contact. The woman who was standing, leaning on the back of the seat of the one sitting in the middle, said, "Don't try to force yourself, dear companion. Just keep your mind as clear and clean as possible and observe everything with all your senses, what you see, what you hear and also what you don't hear. Record it well in your memory. We told you at the beginning that you were going to file many memories in it. Later, when you return to Earth, you will have time to calmly reflect on your experience on board our ship. And you will be able to transcribe your memories and reflections freely, according to your earthly references, which we know you will not be able to give up. You will have already realized the great abyss that separates our respective ways of understanding life. It is not a risk to speak of the existence of two worlds. However, although for now it cannot be said that we are condemned to understand and live together, what does seem unquestionable to us is that, because of this harmful interference of your deadly ships, which endanger the harmony of the universe, so costly organized through millennia, perhaps a new era has begun that we could call frank rapprochement and open contact, which we have been wishing to achieve since time immemorial. We terrestrials call it, every cloud has a silver lining. Yes, that is right, dear comrade, but you must agree with us that it is always preferable to talk and understand each other, based on constructive options, rather than under the cover of fears and threats. Tell me, would you be willing, if suddenly we Earthlings became civilized and generous, to establish regular and definitive contacts and to share with us all your discoveries and secrets. This is something that we have always practiced among the communities that have formed the Universal Brotherhood. It is logical that our attitude towards you was as fraternal as has always been our norm with others. How do you think we could have established our harmonious universal concert? Then, I don't know why I had these changes of course several times, just like that. Suddenly, I asked them about the fate of the messages that the Earthlings had sent into space. They told me they knew them, in particular the last one, in which such idyllic visions of the Earth are transmitted to other interstellar civilizations, that no extraterrestrial civilization, however imbecile its members may be, would believe it. It is not that we like to witness dramatic and depressing scenes, said the woman, but what is certain is that you Earthlings have a great fondness for writing tables of rights and all kinds of declarations and manifestos, and dedicating years to the marginalized, the humiliated and the hungry, which are, in the end, nothing more than pure palliatives. Extraterrestrials in the Mediterranean and L.A. Sardinia. The voice again begged me to pay attention and immediately they began to show me another documentary. I was able to admire some of the many riches that, according to them, our planet contains, and of which we apparently ignore the existence. At first the image is paraded at a dizzying speed, which then, progressively, decreased until they became slow motion. I saw the depths of an African lake, then another in Latin America, and finally we dived into the waters of the Mediterranean. As the documentary unfolded before my eyes, panoramic views that were completely new to me, above all because of their unusual beauty and I believe for any Earthling, no matter how assiduous a movie enthusiast they may be, the voice pointed out that these types of soundings had been carried out recently with small ships that they would later show me. I was also able to see a group of excursionists, of extraterrestrials, exploring, as I was told, the mountains of Sardinia. What people as serious and informed as Antonio Ribera and Juan Garcia Oceanza call the magnetic core of Canigó, without worrying at all about the border that divides Catalonia in two. They assured me that the two superpowers would be astonished, and humiliated, I might add, if one day they revealed to them, as a sign of good friendship, the inventory of all our real resources, including countless unknown riches that are found in their own territories. We can assure you, they told me, that on Earth, whose specialists in the field, Malthusian or not, Malthusianism is a theory that population growth is potentially exponential, according to the Malthusian growth model, while the growth of the food supply or other resources is linear, which eventually reduces living standards to the point of triggering a population decline, are alarmed because by the end of this century your planet may reach 8 billion inhabitants. You have the resources to care for 40 or 50 billion inhabitants with dignity, and without having to plunder and ruin nature, but quite the opposite, harmoniously in tune with it. But to do so, we repeat, the Earth must devote itself fully to peaceful tasks and stop worshipping death, as you have done until now. They assured me that the two superpowers would remain major powers who would be astonished, and humiliated, I might add, if one day they were to reveal to them, as a sign of good friendship, the inventory of all our real resources on Earth, including countless unknown riches found within the borders of the superpowers. Well, that may be the reason I interjected, which you must not ignore, that on Earth it has been spread by certain people specializing in public relations regarding the subject of UFOs, or in matters of national defense, that what you want is for us to do is lower our guard so that you can invade us and seize the treasures of our planet. You know that it has even been said that you lack water and salt, and that you come to supply yourself on Earth. But you don't believe that nonsense. Once again I did not know what to answer, just like that, suddenly, I was afraid that my opinion would sound false. Because the truth is that I have often thought about how foolish that excuse is, that of being afraid of one's neighbor to accumulate munitions and always be on a war footing thinking some terrestrial nation may attack. Therefore, how could I not think the same when referring to extraterrestrial communities? In any case, I said, somehow we will have to face the bull head on once and for all if, as you claim, you have the resources to suspend the life of the inhabitants of one of the two superpowers. If so, and I have no reason to doubt it, perhaps you could intervene. For example, in the sense of attenuating, or even stopping, this tremendous drought that we are currently suffering in almost all of Spain. Or stopping any natural calamity of the many that ravage the world.